The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. Chapter 2. Jorgis talked lightly about work because he was young. They told him stories about the breaking down of men there in the stockyards of Chicago and of what had happened to them afterward. Stories to make your flesh creep. But Jorgis would only laugh. He had only been there 4 months, and he was young and a giant besides. There was too much health in him. He could not even imagine how it would feel to be beaten. "That is well enough for men like you," he would say. "Silpnas, puny fellows, but my back is broad." Jorgis was like a boy from the country. He was the sort of man the bosses like to get hold of, the sort they make it a grievance they cannot get hold of. When he was told to go to a certain place, he would go there on the run. When he had nothing to do for the moment, he would stand around fidgeting, dancing with the overflow of energy that was in him. If he were working in a line of men, the line always moved too slowly for him, and you could pick him out by his impatience and restlessness. That was why he had been picked out on one important occasion, for Jorgis had stood outside of Brown and Company's Central Time Station not more than half an hour the second day of his arrival in Chicago before he had been beckoned by one of the bosses. Of this he was very proud, and it made him more disposed than ever to laugh at the pessimists. In vain would they all tell him that there were men in that crowd from which he had been chosen who had stood there a month, yes, many months, and had not been chosen yet. "Yes," he would say, "but what sort of men? Broken-down tramps and good-for-nothing fellows, fellows who have spent all their money drinking and want to get more for it. Do you want me to believe that with these arms—" and he would clench his fists and hold them up in the air so that you might see the rolling muscles, "that with these arms people will ever let me starve?" "It is plain," they would answer to this, "that you have come from the country, and from very far in the country." And this was the fact, for Jorgis had never seen a city, and scarcely even a fair-sized town, until he had set out to make his fortune in the world and earn his right to Ona. His father, and his father's father before him, and as many ancestors back as legend could go, had lived in that part of Lithuania known as Brezhlovich, the Imperial Forest. This is a great tract of 100,000 acres, which from time immemorial has been a hunting preserve of the nobility. There are a very few peasants settled in it, holding title from ancient times, and one of these was Antanas Rudkus, who had been reared himself and had reared his children in turn upon a half a dozen acres of cleared land in the midst of a wilderness. There had been one son beside Jorgis and one sister. The former had been drafted into the army, that had been over 10 years ago, but since that day nothing had ever been heard of him. The sister was married, and her husband had bought the place when old Antanas had decided to go with his son. It was nearly a year and a half ago that Jorgis had met Ona at a horse fair 100 miles from home. Jorgis had never expected to get married. He had laughed at it as a foolish trap for a man to walk into. But here, without ever having spoken a word to her, with no more than the exchange of half a dozen smiles, he found himself purple in the face with embarrassment and terror, asking her parents to sell her to him for his wife, and offering his father's 2 horses he had been sent to the fair to sell. But Ona's father proved as a rock. The girl was yet a child, and he was a rich man, and his daughter was not to be had in that way. So Jorgis went home with a heavy heart, and that spring and summer toiled and tried hard to forget. In the fall, after the harvest was over, he saw that it would not do, and tramped the full fortnight's journey that lay between him and Ona. He found an unexpected state of affairs, for the girl's father had died, and his estate was tied up with creditors. Jorgis's heart leaped as he realized that now the prize was within his reach. There was Elzbieta Lukaszait, Tita, or Aunt as they called her, Ona's stepmother, and there were her 6 children of all ages. There was also her brother, Jonas, a dried-up little man who had worked upon the farm. They were people of great consequence, as it seemed to Jorgis, fresh out of the woods. Ona knew how to read, and knew many other things that he did not know. And now the farm had been sold, and the whole family was adrift, all they owned in the world being about 700 rubles, which is half as many dollars. They would have had 3 times that, but it had gone to court, and the judge had decided against them, and it had cost the balance to get him to change his decision. Ona might have married and left them, but she would not, for she loved Teta Elzbieta. It was Jonas who suggested that they all go to America, where a friend of his had gotten rich. He would work for his part, and the women would work, and some of the children, doubtless, they would live somehow. Jorgis, too, had heard of America. That was a country where they said a man might earn 3 rubles a day. And Jorgis figured what 3 rubles a day would mean, with prices as they were where he lived, and decided forthwith that he would go to America and marry and be a rich man in the bargain. In that country, rich or poor, a man was free, it was said. He did not have to go into the army. He did not have to pay out his money to rascally officials. He might do as he pleased and count himself as good as any other man. So, America was a place of which lovers and young people dreamed. If one could only manage to get the price of a passage, he could count his troubles at an end. It was arranged that they should leave the following spring, and meantime Jorgis sold himself to a contractor for a certain time, and tramped nearly 400 miles from home with a gang of men to work upon a railroad in Smolensk. This was a fearful experience, with filth and bad food and cruelty and overwork. But Jorgis stood it, and came out in fine trim, and with 80 rubles sewed up in his coat. He did not drink or fight, because he was thinking all the time of Ona, and for the rest, he was a quiet, steady man who did what he was told to do, did not lose his temper often, and when he did lose it, it made the offender anxious that he should not lose it again. When they paid him off, he dodged the company gamblers and dram shops, and so they tried to kill him. But he escaped and tramped at home, working at odd jobs and sleeping always with one eye open. So, in the summertime, they had all set out for America. At the last moment, there joined them Mariha Bezinskas, who was a cousin of Ona's. Mariha was an orphan and had worked since childhood for a rich farmer of Vilna, who beat her regularly. It was only at the age of 20 that it had occurred to Mariha to try her strength, when she had risen up and nearly murdered the man, and then come away. There were 12 in all in the party, 5 adults and 6 children, and Ona, who was a little of both. They had a hard time on the passage. There was an agent who helped them, but he proved a scoundrel and got them into a trap with some officials and cost them a good deal of their precious money, which they clung to with such horrible fear. This happened to them again in New York, for, of course, they knew nothing about the country and had no one to tell them, and it was easy for a man in a blue uniform to lead them away and try to take them to a hotel and keep them there and make them pay enormous charges to get away. The law says that the rate card shall be on the door of a hotel, but it does not say that it shall be in Lithuanian. It was in the stockyards that Jonah's friend had gotten rich, and so to Chicago the party was bound. They knew that one word, Chicago, and that was all they needed to know, at least until they reached the city. Then, tumbled out of the cars without ceremony, they were no better off than before. They stood staring down the vista of Dearborn Street, with its big black buildings towering in the distance, unable to realize that they had arrived, and why, when they said Chicago, people no longer pointed in some direction, but instead looked perplexed, or laughed, or went on without paying any attention. They were pitiable in their helplessness. Above all things, they stood in deadly terror of any sort of person in official uniform, and so whenever they saw a policeman, they would cross the street and hurry by. For the whole of the first day, they wandered about in the midst of deafening confusion, utterly lost, and it was only at night that, cowering in the doorway of a house, they were finally discovered and taken by a policeman to the station. In the morning an interpreter was found, and they were taken and put upon a car and taught a new word, stockyards. Their delight at discovering that they were to get out of this adventure without losing another share of their possessions it would not be possible to describe. They sat and stared out of the window. They were on a street which seemed to run on forever, mile after mile, 34 of them, if they had known it, and each side of it one uninterrupted row of wretched little 2-story frame buildings. Down every side street they could see, it was the same. Never a hill and never a hollow, but always the same endless vista of ugly and dirty little wooden buildings. Here and there there would be a bridge crossing a filthy creek with hard-baked mud shores and dingy sheds and docks along it. Here and there would be a railroad crossing with a tangle of switches and locomotives puffing and rattling freight cars filing by. Here and there would be a great factory, a dingy building with innumerable windows in it and immense volumes of smoke pouring from the chimneys, darkening the air above and making filthy the earth beneath. But after each of these interruptions, the desolate procession would begin again, the procession of dreary little buildings. A full hour before the party reached the city, they had begun to note the perplexing changes in the atmosphere. It grew darker all the time, and upon the earth the grass seemed to grow less green. Every minute as the train sped on, the colors of things became dingier. The fields were grown parched and yellow, the landscape hideous and bare. And along with the thickening smoke, they began to notice another circumstance, a strange, pungent odor. They were not sure that it was unpleasant, this odor. Some might have called it sickening, but their taste in odors was not developed, and they were only sure that it was curious. Now, sitting in the trolley car, they realized that they were on their way to the home of it, that they had traveled all the way from Lithuania to it. It was now no longer something far off and faint that you caught in whiffs. You could literally taste it as well as smell it. You could take hold of it, almost, and examine it at your leisure. They were divided in their opinions about it. It was an elemental odor, raw and crude. It was rich, almost rancid, sensual and strong. There were some who drank it in as if it were an intoxicant. There were others who put their handkerchiefs to their faces. The new emigrants were still tasting it, lost in wonder, when suddenly the car came to a halt, and the door was flung open, and a voice shouted, "Stockyards!" They were left standing upon the corner, staring. Down a side street, there were two rows of brick houses, and between them a vista. Half a dozen chimneys, tall as the tallest of buildings, touching the very sky, and leaping from them half a dozen columns of smoke, thick, oily, and black as night. It might have come from the center of the world, this smoke, where the fires of the ages still smolder. It came as if self-impelled, driving all before it a perpetual explosion. It was inexhaustible. One stared, waiting to see it stop. But still the great streams rolled out. They spread in vast clouds overhead, writhing, curling, then uniting in one giant river. They streamed away down the sky, stretching a black pall as far as the eye could reach. Then the party became aware of another strange thing. This, too, like the color, was a thing elemental. It was a sound made up of 10,000 little sounds. You scarcely noticed it at first. It sunk into your consciousness, a vague disturbance, a trouble. It was like the murmuring of the bees in the spring, the whisperings of the forest. It suggested endless activity, the rumblings of a world in motion. It was only by an effort that one could realize that it was made by animals, that it was the distant lowing of 10,000 cattle, the distant grunting of 10,000 swine. They would have liked to follow it up, but alas, they had no time for adventures just then. The policeman on the corner was beginning to watch them, and so, as usual, they started up the street. Scarcely had they gone a block, however, before Jonas was heard to give a cry and began pointing excitedly across the street. Before they could gather the meaning of his breathless ejaculations, he had bounded away, and they saw him enter a shop over which was a sign, J. Sidvilis, Delicatessen. When he came out again, it was in company with a very stout gentleman in shirt sleeves and an apron, clasping Jonas by both hands and laughing hilariously. Then Teta Elzbieta recollected suddenly that Sidvilis had been the name of the mythical friend who had made his fortune in America. To find that he had been making it in the delicatessen business was an extraordinary piece of good fortune at this juncture, though it was well on in the morning. They had not breakfasted, and the children were beginning to whimper. Thus was the happy ending to a woeful voyage. The two families literally fell upon each other's necks, for it had been years since Jokubas Sedvilis had met a man from his part of Lithuania. Before half the day they were lifelong friends. Jokubas understood all the pitfalls of this new world and could explain all of its mysteries. He could tell them the things they ought to have done in the different emergencies, and, what was still more to the point, he could tell them what to do now. He would take them to Ponli Aniel, who kept a boarding house the other side of the yards. Old Mrs. Junknien, he explained, had not what one would call choice accommodations, but they might do for the moment. To this Teta Elzbieta hastened to respond that nothing could be too cheap to suit them just then, for they were quite terrified over the sums they had had to expend. A very few days of practical experience in this land of high wages had been sufficient to make clear to them the cruel fact that it was also a land of high prices, and that in it the poor man was almost as poor as in any other corner of the earth. And so there vanished in a night all the wonderful dreams of wealth that had been haunting Jorgis. What had made the discovery all the more painful was that they were spending at American prices money which they had earned at home rates of wages, and so were really being cheated by the world. The last 2 days they had all but starved themselves. It made them quite sick to pay the prices that the railroad people asked them for food. Yet, when they saw the home of the widow Yuk Nien, they could not but recoil even so. In all their journey they had seen nothing so bad as this. Pony Anyele had a four-room flat in one of that wilderness of two-story frame tenements that lie back of the yards. There were four such flats in each building, and each of the four was a boarding house for the occupancy of foreigners, Lithuanians, Poles, Slovaks, or Bohemians. Some of these places were kept by private persons, some were cooperative. There would be an average of half a dozen boarders to each room. Sometimes there were 13 or 14 to one room, 50 or 60 to a flat. Each one of the occupants furnished his own accommodations, that is, a mattress and some bedding. The mattresses would be spread upon the floor in rows, and there would be nothing else in the place except a stove. It was by no means unusual for two men to own the same mattress in common, one working by day and using it by night, and the other working at night and using it in the daytime. Very frequently, a lodging housekeeper would rent the same beds to double shifts of men. Mrs. Yuk Nien was a wizened-up little woman with a wrinkled face. Her home was unthinkably filthy. You could not enter by the front door at all, owing to the mattresses, and when you tried to go up the back stairs, you found that she had walled up most of the porch with old boards to make a place to keep her chickens. It was standing jest of the boarders that Anyele cleaned house by letting the chickens loose in the rooms. Undoubtedly, this did keep down the vermin, but it seemed probable, in view of all the circumstances, that the old lady regarded it rather as feeding the chickens than as cleaning the rooms. The truth was that she had definitely given up the idea of cleaning anything under pressure of an attack of rheumatism, which had kept her doubled up in one corner of her room for over a week, during which time 11 of her boarders, heavily in her debt, had concluded to try their chances of employment in Kansas City. This was July, and the fields were green. One never saw the fields, nor any green thing whatever in Packingtown, but one could go out on the road and hobo it, as the men phrased it, and see the country and have a long rest, and an easy time riding on the freight cars. Such was the home to which the new arrivals were welcomed. There was nothing better to be had. They might not do so well by looking further, for Mrs. Yuk Nien had at least kept one room for herself and her three little children, and now offered to share this with the women and the girls of the party. They could get bedding at a second-hand store, she explained, and they would not need any while the weather was so hot. Doubtless they would all sleep on the sidewalk such nights as this, as did nearly all of her guests. "Tomorrow," Jorge said, when they were left alone, "tomorrow I will get a job, and perhaps Jonas will get one also, and then we can get a place of our own." Later that afternoon, he and Ona went out to take a walk and look about them, to see more of this district which was to be their home. In back of the yards, the dreary two-story frame houses were scattered farther apart, and there were great spaces, bare, that seemingly had been overlooked by the great soar of a city as it spread itself over the surface of the prairie. These bare places were grown up with dingy yellow weeds, hiding innumerable tomato cans. Innumerable children played upon them, chasing one another here and there, screaming and fighting. The most uncanny thing about this neighborhood was the number of children. You thought there must be a school just out, and it was only after long acquaintance that you were able to realize that there was no school, but that these were the children of the neighborhood, that there were so many children to the block in Packingtown that nowhere on its streets could a horse and buggy move faster than a walk. It could not move faster anyhow on account of the state of the streets. Those through which Jorgis and Ona were walking resembled streets less than they did a miniature topographical map. The roadway was commonly several feet lower than the level of the houses, which were sometimes joined by high board walks. There were no pavements. There were mountains and valleys and rivers, gullies and ditches, and great hollows full of stinking green water. In these pools the children played and rolled about in the mud of the streets. Here and there one noticed them digging in it after trophies which they had stumbled on. One wondered about this, as also about the swarms of flies which hung about the scene, literally blackening the air, and the strange, fetid odor which assailed one's nostrils, a ghastly odor of all the dead things of the universe. It impelled the visitor to questions, and then the residents would explain, quietly, that all this was made land, and that it had been made by using it as a dumping ground for the city garbage. After a few years, the unpleasant effect of this would pass away, it was said. But meantime, in hot weather, and especially when it rained, the flies were apt to be annoying. Was it not unhealthful? The stranger would ask, and the residents would answer, "Perhaps, but there is no telling." A little way farther on, and Jorgis and Ona, staring open-eyed and wondering, came to the place where this made ground was in process of making. Here was a great hole, perhaps 2 city blocks square, and with long files of garbage wagons creeping into it. The place had an odor for which there are no polite words, and it was sprinkled over with children, who raked in it from dawn till dark. Sometimes visitors from the packing houses would wander out to see this dump, and they would stand by and debate as to whether the children were eating the food they got or merely collecting it for the chickens at home. Apparently, none of them ever went down to find out. Beyond this dump, there stood a great brickyard with smoking chimneys. First, they took out the soil to make bricks, and then they filled it up again with garbage, which seemed to Jorgis and Ona a felicitous arrangement, characteristic of an enterprising country like America. A little way beyond was another great hole, which they had emptied and not yet filled up. This held water, and all summer it stood there with the nearby soil draining into it, festering and stewing in the sun, and when winter came, somebody cut the ice on it and sold it to the people of the city. This, too, seemed to the newcomers an economical arrangement, for they did not read the newspapers, and their heads were not full of troublesome thoughts about germs. They stood there while the sun went down upon the scene, and the sky in the west turned blood red, and the tops of the houses shone like fire. Jorgis and Ona were not thinking of the sunset, however. Their backs were turned to it, and all their thoughts were of Packingtown, which they could see so plainly in the distance. The line of the building stood clear-cut and black against the sky. Here and there, out of the mass, rose the great chimneys, with the river of smoke streaming away to the end of the world. It was a study in colors now, this smoke. In the sunset light it was black and brown and gray and purple. All the sordid suggestions of the place were gone. In the twilight it was a vision of power. To the two who stood watching while the darkness swallowed it up, it seemed like a dream of wonder with its talc of human energy, of things being done, of employment for thousands upon thousands of men, of opportunity and freedom, of life and love and joy. When they came away, arm in arm, Jorgis was saying, "Tomorrow I shall go there and get the job." The end of Chapter 2. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit to Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.